Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Few nations have as complicated and whiplash-inducing a history as Afghanistan. While people have lived in the region for tens of thousands of years, what we think of as the modern history of Afghanistan dates back a little more than two centuries. Its beginnings, in some ways, run parallel to our own here in the U.S. But the similarities largely end there, as in the ensuing 200-plus years, while the United States struggled internally with a civil war, it essentially avoided foreign incursion on our soil. Afghanistan, meanwhile, faced five separate invasions, occupations, or other forms of control from other nations. The British tried three times, the Soviets once, and today the U.S. and NATO continue to seek to extricate themselves fully from the country more than 10 years after the attacks of and response to 9/11. Tamim Ansari writes about this, what he calls historical amnesia, in his new book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. In it, he considers the impact such interruptions have had on Afghanistan and any prospects for a more peaceful, democratic, and prosperous future for the country. Tamim Ansari is a writer, lecturer, editor, and teacher. He directs the San Francisco Writers Workshop, teaches through the Osher Institute, and has written extensively about Afghanistan and the complicated relationship between Islam and the West. Tamim Ansari, welcome to Focus.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. And as we begin our conversation, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also reach out to us on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Now, as your title suggests, Afghanistan's history is rife with what you characterize as interruptions, incursions by other nations into Afghanistan. Is it your impression that Americans and maybe people in the West in general see those interruptions as the history of Afghanistan?
Well, it's only when there is an interruption that Afghanistan comes to the attention of the world. So I think the general narrative of Afghanistan that's familiar to the West is this invasion happened, and then Afghanistan disappeared, didn't exist for a while, and then, this other invasion happened. So, yeah, I think that's the continuous thread that the world more or less knows.
And what sort of surprises me about that as I was reading your book is just how fascinating the history of what the internal machinations are within Afghanistan for the last 200 years has been. Really fascinating. And there are people and ideas that have been expressed through that country and from, in some cases, from its leaders that I think might surprise some of our listeners.
Yeah, it's a complicated history, but it's also such a dramatic history, and it's so peopled with, you know, intriguing, fascinating characters. I just have to tell the story.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the history that gets interrupted.
Okay.
Let's start with what I alluded to, that there were maybe some early parallels between colonial America and the events that gave rise to Afghanistan as a country. And in particular, I guess we should start with Ahmad Khan. Who was he?
Well, Ahmad Shah was the last in a long series of conquerors who emerged out of this region. And, you know, generally, every few generations, one of these guys would somehow spring up. And usually what they did was they rallied the tribal guerrilla armies or built some kind of a force and went conquering. They went into India. Sometimes they went west into what's now Iran. And they built a loose, ramshackle empire. And the thing about the empire was that whoever the emperor was, he didn't have much to do with the daily lives of people. Most of the subjects within his within the, I shouldn't call them boundaries, but within this loose area that he considered his empire, most of those people, most of the time, their lives were governed by custom, tradition, and local elders and clerics and the understanding of Islam that people had, which was some mixture of, you know, official scholarly Islam and customs and folkways of the people. So that's what really governed life at the ground level. And what generally happened, and happened with Ahmad Shah too, was that the great man would build the empire, his sons would fight over it, the grandsons would lose it, the whole thing would crumble. Then there'd be no one for a while, and then another guy would rise. So this is what happened in Ahmad Shah's time, but two things. One is that he was a Pashtun, and the other name for Pashtuns was Afghans. That was at one time those were synonymous. So his empire at that point started to be known as Land of the Afghans, which in Farsi that's Afghanistan or Afghanistan. So that name sort of comes into history. And the other thing is that in his time, all of a sudden, there were other powers in the region. There were the British in India, and the Russians were starting to come east and south. So all of a sudden, the equation kind of changed there over the course of a couple of decades.
And we're talking about what here, the 1740s and 50s? Roughly?
Well, his reign began in 1750, roughly. And his dynasty ruled till into the 1800s, and then there was a period of civil war in Afghanistan, and that was that usual civil war, the warring sons period, we should call it, or the warring grandsons period. And as a new ruler emerged out of that chaos, he was a fellow named Dost Mohammad, and usually, the moniker Dost Mohammad the Great was given to him in Afghan history as long as his dynasty was ruling. And that guy emerged, and he couldn't do what the previous guy had done because the British were there, the Russians were there, and at that point, the history of Afghanistan took on a new cast.
Before we get to all of that, let's talk a little bit more about Ahmad Khan. Some have characterized him as the George Washington of Afghanistan. I don't know if that's a fair characterization, but are there some appropriate comparisons to draw?
Well, he's remembered as Ahmad Shah Baba, which means Ahmad Shah the father. So in a sense, retrospectively, Afghans saw him as the founder and father of Afghanistan. And it's true that from his time on, his tribe and, the few related clans then were the rulers of Afghanistan until 1978, basically. So one clan more or less ruled the country for almost 200 years, and he was the founding father of that rule. He didn't build modern Afghanistan because that's still going on, actually.
Right.
No one built it. It keeps being partially built and then crumbling again. And he built it partially and it crumbled again. Now, George Washington presided over the installation of a process of government and society that with orderly changes has lasted to this day and hopefully will continue. And in Afghanistan, Ahmad Shah established something that was, that crumbled and was resurrected and crumbled and was resurrected. It followed a different course there.
I was going to ask you if that was something that maybe is missing from Afghanistan and its development. I mean, one of the reasons that Washington is so revered beyond being our first president was this sort of tacit understanding of the need to peacefully step aside for the next elected leader. And that's a different construct than what Afghanistan has had the last couple hundred years.
Yeah, that's a different construct. And let me toss one other thing into the ring there. George Washington stepped aside so that an objective process might go forth. And it was the beginning of, or not the beginning of, but in the West, it was becoming established that an office existed separate from the person who occupied that office. And in Afghanistan, a leader emerged because he gradually accrued prestige among his peers. And that's how leadership emerged at the local level. That's an elder was not appointed by anybody and not elected by anybody. And he wasn't even necessarily an old man. And if you were old, you weren't necessarily an elder.
Mm-hmm.
The elders were these guys who accumulated prestige. And they could lose it that same way, just by doing shameful things or something. Then they wouldn't be a leader. And so that's how it worked at the ground level. And then at the next level up, the elders of a region, they might somebody in that group might accrue prestige and he'd be a bigger leader. And somebody like Ahmad Shah, who was, the emperor, the top guy, he was actually kind of elected, There was a crucial moment for the Pashtun tribes in Afghanistan. There was chaos coming. The Persian Empire had crumbled. And the tribes got together and had the Afghan version of a democratic process, which is a council at which the big figures get together and talk until they come to a decision. And in this case, all these major tribal elders talk for 9 days. They wanted to get one guy at the head of the tribal confederation, so that they would be able to hold together in the face of the chaos they knew was coming. They didn't intend to put a guy up there to be their king forever. But they finally settled on Ahmad Shah, and once he was, the consensual leader of the Pashtun Tribal Confederation, then he built his army, then he went conquering, and there was a feedback loop. As long as he was conquering, he was, his prestige lasted, especially if he conquered into areas that were not Muslim, and as long as his conquest continued to feed resources and wealth back into his base, so to speak. So that's how he was, and that's how he came into being. I forget what question we took off from there.
That's all right. No, it's that's it exactly. I kind of wanted to get into this idea that as you write, that Ahmad Shah united the Pashtun tribes more than anyone ever had.
Yeah.
And I guess that you sort of laid that out. You also note that during Ahmad Shah's rule, Afghanistan wasn't a fully defined territory. We do tend to think of the beginning of nations as being sort of the beginning of border lines that are clearly established, but it was really more zones than border lines. When did that begin to change?
That really began to change in about 50 years later, right after that period when Ahmad Shah's empire had gone through a fragmentation and the next big guy came along. This is when the influence of the Brits and the Russians first becomes obvious in Afghan history. That fellow wanted to resurrect the empire, the standard Afghan empire.
And this is Dost Muhammad.
Yeah, this is Dost Muhammad. And he couldn't quite do it because he couldn't push into India, where Afghan conquerors traditionally had gone, because of the British being there. And really, what he wanted was to reconquer the city of Peshawar, because Pashtuns had always figured that was one of their cities. It was part of the birthright. And the British would not let him. And gradually, over the course of the next 50 years, whoever was ruling Afghanistan, that guy and then his heirs and followers, gradually they came to an accommodation with the British that said, okay, we won't try to conquer India. We'll stop. Where should we stop? How about right here? We'll have it up to here, and we won't go past here. And that negotiation became the definition of the southern and eastern border of Afghanistan.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Tamima Ansari, author of Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. And we are discussing the past, and we'll discuss the present and future of Afghanistan. And we welcome your questions and comments this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what led to England's interest in and then first incursion into Afghanistan. So there's a sort of agreed-to sense of where the border would lie and this sense of, well, we won't move in if you don't do this, that sort of tacit agreement. At what point did it become a circumstance where England, in essence, seemed to want to maybe colonize Afghanistan? Is that a fair statement?
They never really wanted to colonize Afghanistan, and it's characteristic of incursions in Afghanistan that the intervening or invading power never really wants to occupy and live there. in the old days, that conquerors would sweep through and remnants of them would end up in the valleys, and they would be the inhabitants of this territory, and that's who the Afghans are. It's all the people who conquered it. But the British didn't want to conquer Afghanistan. They were looking over Afghanistan at the Russians. And they were concerned that if the Russians came in and if they occupied Afghanistan, they'd be in the catbird seat to launch that standard invasion of India that had come from those highlands again and again over the centuries. And since Britain was at that point the most wealthy and powerful nation on earth, and a lot of that wealth and power was rooted in the fact that they possessed India as a colony, they were very anxious not to let the Russians take any part of that. So at some point, they decided that the best strategy was to push forward, past the mountainous hump of Afghanistan, and hold the line against Russia north of Afghanistan. They didn't think in terms of conquering Afghanistan. They thought in terms of taking out the ruler who was there and putting in a guy they figured would be a compliant, loyal partner slash puppet, and to control Afghanistan that way. And they would enforce upon that guy the one inflexible rule that he must never let a Russian cross the border or cross that northern river and come into Afghanistan. And so that was their attempt. And as soon as they did that the first time, which was in 1839, the fellow they installed couldn't hold anything, couldn't govern Afghanistan. The whole thing fell apart, and the British were not able to function there, so they left. And then the same thing happened again 40 years later.
Yeah, that's what I really wanted to get to next. This notion of some time passes and, well, let's try again.
Yeah.
And it's what you characterize in your book as historical amnesia.
Yeah.
Why do you think that amnesia persisted and maybe does to some degree to this day?
It did persist and it does to this day. And one of the syndromes there is that each time the power that comes in thinks they're different, thinks they're doing something different. And, the first time the Brits came, they brought in what they considered was a sufficient army. And I think they didn't properly analyze the nature of their disaster. At the end of that first time, their resolution of the problem was to take out the guy that they had installed, or actually he was assassinated, and they put back in the very guy they had ousted. Mm. And they issued a declaration that said something to the effect that, we went into Afghanistan because we were told by somebody that this guy was unpopular and we wanted to put in a popular king. But it turns out we were wrong. This was the popular guy, and far be it from us to, contravene the will of the people. So we're helping him take this legitimate throne back, and they did, and he made the deal that they wanted. He said no Russians in Afghanistan, and I'll accept this southern border. And 40 years later, the Russians were at it again. They were on the move, and politics had gone through a couple of cycles in Britain, and a party was back in power that considered the previous party to be wimps on foreign policy, and they remembered that the first time it didn't work, but they figured that was because they used only one army. So this time they brought three the size of that. They had the impression that the last time they didn't have people in there who understood the Afghans. Now they figured, much more experience on the northwest frontier of India. And they had old, frontier hands, British guys who knew the Pashtuns and knew how to deal with them. And they sent in a fellow who was thought to be, effective in that way. It turned out, it was eerie how they repeated almost the exact same drama, down to things like 40 years earlier, the fellow who was the political agent in Kabul. He was assuring the authorities in India that everything was calm, Afghanistan was under control, everything was going to be okay by Christmas. And, a month after he issued that declaration about that long, he was dead. There was a mob convened. They attacked his house and they killed him. 40 years later, the guy who took his place, who was in the same position, issued very much the same kind of statement. He, too, his house was surrounded by a mob who was discontented about something. He was holed up in a place that had low walls surrounded by hills, which was exactly what the other guy had done. The mob poured in. They killed him. So it was the exact same thing. And then the British Army came in and quelled the rebellion and used military force to bring the country under control. And as in the last period, this army they brought in, it was able to win every actual battle, but it couldn't stop violence from happening.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, it's like the error that they made was to suppose that they had a particular enemy in Afghanistan, and that by conquering that enemy, they could then make Afghanistan governable. And it didn't work two times for the British, and then the Soviets really suffered a catastrophe on that. And I think we're somewhat in the same quandary now.
Is there any way to extrapolate what might have happened in Afghanistan had the British not been involved in the ways that they were in the 1830s, or, you know, 1839, then 40 years later, then 60 years after that?
Well, you know, the what-if history that you're posing, it's hard to extrapolate for me, because it is a reality of Afghanistan that it's going to be surrounded by these big powers. That's just never not going to be the case. So Afghan history is a curious mix of Afghans falling into contentions amongst themselves about what kind of a nation they have and what the nature of this nation should be. That's always coupled with, and these guys are on our borders, how do we deal with them? And the question of what our nation should be always has to take into account, how does that relate to the guys on the outside who have terms they want to dictate?
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the past, present, and future of Afghanistan with Tamim Ansari, author of the new book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. We welcome your questions and comments this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Those phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. So who led or controlled Afghanistan then through the first half of the 20th century?
Well, it was a family, and this family was descended from Dost Muhammad. And this family's rule had been presaged by a incredibly, you know, sort of ruthless, brutal, but brilliant king who established a bureaucracy that he laid over the country like a blanket. So it covered every part of the country, and he had completely firmed up the borders. The shape of his Afghanistan was the shape of today's Afghanistan. And he had created a outward-looking bureaucracy that was completely controlled from the center, from Kabul. But out there, what the blanket was lying on was the same old Afghanistan of tribes, elders, clerics, local this, local that. So these two Afghanistans were going on at the same time. And then in the 20th century, his sons and grandsons, in the first, let's say, 30 years of it, they enjoyed largely a quiet and peaceful era. And, you know, in that time, they issued the declaration that they were independent of Britain. There was a little bit of a war. They went to the negotiating table. They won the negotiation, actually. They won their independence at the conference. And after that, they launched this rapid-fire social development, create a metamorphosis of Afghanistan attempt. And during the 20s, you know, the king of Afghanistan wrote his own code of law that said, no burqas, women go to school, girls go to school, we're going to develop the country, we're going to build this and that, men can't grow beards anymore if they want to work for the government, and all these kinds of out with the old, in with the new.
And this was King Amanullah, correct?
Yeah, this was King Amanullah.
Amanullah.
And, you know, they were aware of the outside world. They saw that there was science out there, there was, you know, modern medicine, there was electricity, and they wanted all those things for Afghanistan.
I think this would surprise a lot of people who maybe are not familiar with the history of Afghanistan, certainly in terms of how it is often portrayed in the media. There's this perception of the last couple of centuries that in Afghanistan, there's never been anyone in a leadership position really pushing in a dramatic way towards those kinds of reforms, developments.
Oh, it was dramatic, and it was an ongoing struggle in Afghanistan over the whole course of the 20th century. And, you know, these guys that I just mentioned, Prince Amanullah, then he became King Amanullah, he was part of this whole sort of youth movement, radical progressive youth movement in Kabul, which had been, it was spiked and fueled by the return of exiles from places like Turkey, Ottoman Turkey, where the young Turks were also interested in these same ideas. And so these guys came, and there was a fervor and an intellectual ferment in Kabul and in the cities. Lots of young Afghans excited about the fact that now we're going to be part of the world, and they were writing poetry about things like medicine and vaccines, and, you know, they were enthusiastic about all that. And that king, Amanullah, he actually was the first Afghan king to travel to Europe, where he and his wife encountered a tremendously enthusiastic reception. And he had appointed his wife to be the Minister of Education in Afghanistan. So, you know, she was like a leading feminist, and there's all that excitement, but it was like over the course of 10 years, these guys wanted to completely alter the Afghan social fabric, and there was a backlash.
So it's too much too fast.
Too much too fast.
And how was, in particular, how did King Amanullah seek to square his, what he, you know, his book of order, these much more modern rules with what had been established, what was characterized maybe as Sharia law, but what was seen as, no, that's not the way we do things.
How did he square one with the other?
Yeah, because were they operating in concert? Was he basically proclaiming these will be the new laws of the land replacing the old, or will they work side by side?
Oh, you know, he kind of avoided the question. He said,
okay,
these are the new laws, and the Sharia, yeah, that too, I guess, you know. he didn't, and I will say that to this day, that question has not been confronted. In the constitution that Afghans are operating under right now, there are many planks that legislate progressive social reforms on the question of gender relations and of women's place in society. And at the same time, there's a lot of language that says no law in this constitution or in Afghanistan can go against the Sharia. So that sort of begs the question of what if a law in this constitution, is in opposition to something in the Sharia? That would have to be worked out, and the constitution refuses to work it out. It just says, well, when the time comes, we'll look at that.
Well, in fact, I believe you noted in the book that King Amanullah, in his book of order, suggested that there should be a freedom of religion in Afghanistan without specifying what that meant.
Without specifying what that meant, and, you know, in the Sharia, it is one of the stated planks that once you have become a Muslim, if you are a Muslim, you may not convert and become adherent to a different religion. And that's considered to be a transgression akin to treason and punishable. So the clerical establishment didn't know what he meant, and he didn't say. And it could have been interpreted that freedom of religion meant, people are free to practice Islam in their own way. he didn't push it to the crisis. But I think eventually, the feeling did develop that no, this guy is trying to replace the laws of Islam with his own law.
It does seem perhaps that this is the national conversation that Afghanistan maybe has not had.
And keeps trying to have. You know, this is the national conversation that has hovered in the background of Afghan social life and Afghan politics ever since, the 20th century opened up. And the thing that happens is that, there is, on the one hand, that aspect of modernism that is very material, cars, roads, houses, medicine, electricity, all that stuff. And the question is, can you have all that and still have the social forms that Afghanistan had in the old days, the main plank of which is the sequestration of women within compounds in a public life that belongs entirely to men. At some level, freedom of expression, freedom of thought, freedom of politicking. Can you have invention, creativity, and progress without having freedom of thought that has no limits? And that's the conversation that Afghanistan is edging towards but has never really quite confronted yet.
Well, don't those freedoms start with those freedom of thoughts versus the modernity, the modernization? You don't need automobiles to have a democratic thought or an independent thought.
No, you don't need automobiles to have independent thought. But if automobiles is what you really want, and you don't care about independent thought.
Okay.
if it's automobiles you want, the question is, can you really have automobiles without independent thought? The proposition is, yes, you can. And I've heard this all over I've heard it in other parts of the Muslim world. No reason why Muslims can't build cars. Why can't we build a car? Well, you can. But the question is, if no cars existed, could you invent a car if there isn't the climate of freedom of opinion, freedom of thought? That's the question. Democracy also is dependent on freedom of thought. You really can't have one without the other. And I would say, I'm jumping ahead here a little bit, but I would say that, the most important thing that's happening in Afghanistan now is not a parliament with elections. There's a lot about that that's cumbersome and fake in Afghanistan. But what isn't is that Afghanistan has magazines, newspapers, radio stations, and television stations now, and it has journalists who are, man, they are, mad dog, go after the truth journalists, such as we rarely see here in America now. And so that's actual, that's actual freedom of thought that's happening, and I don't know if there's going to be a reaction and all that will be squashed, but at the moment it isn't. And some really daring journalistic stuff is happening in Afghanistan. That's where the real progress might come from.
We're discussing Afghanistan with writer, editor, lecturer, and teacher Tamim Ansari. His latest book is Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. To join our conversation, you can call us right now at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email your question or comment to will-talk, that's WILL-TALK, at illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear revelations from well-known actors like Zach Galifianakis on the story behind his last name.
It's actually shortened, Terry. My real last name is Galifianakisberg. That's an exclusive for your show.
Fresh Air, bringing you some of the biggest names in American culture and some of the most difficult to pronounce. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal in Champaign. Eastern Rug Gallery offers professional cleaning and repair service for Oriental and other handmade rugs and provides repair and restoration services for fringe and sides, holes, rips, and animal stains.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Tamim Ansari, author of Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. We are discussing the past, present, and future of that country at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We welcome your questions and comments, or as always, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. So when we left off, we were talking about King Amanullah and his Book of Order. These sort of very modern rules, laws to live by. How long did that concept last?
Well, his whole reign lasted a little over 10 years, and he was ousted in about, in 1929 an insurrection arose, and it had the character of the Talibanist kind of insurgency that developed against communists later on. the insurrection toppled him, but the extreme reactionaries that took over only lasted nine months. And then a new dynasty related to Amon Law came in, and in about 1930, they started to operate. And they took up the same program, actually, but they did it sort of surreptitiously. They did it by first establishing that they were conservatives, they were social conservatives, they were religious conservatives, they were going to enforce the laws of Islam, the Sharia ruled. Then they began inching towards the kinds of reforms that Amon Law talked about. And it began with, you know, they reopened those secular schools that Amon Law had created. They sent a trickle of students abroad to get university educations in the West. They began to very slowly, carefully establish schooling for girls at the lower levels, and then eventually those turned into high schools. And, you know, and so alongside of all that, they also then built roads and did that kind of development, too. And it took 40 years, and they really had made a lot of progress by, let's say, the late 60s.
Meantime, the Cold War comes along.
Yeah.
How did Afghanistan come to be a sort of political football during the Cold War?
Well, it was actually the same. The Cold War was really the great game. You know, the great game was the political jockeying between the British Empire and the Russian Empire. And the Cold War just replaced British with American and its allies, and the Russians were replaced by the Soviet Union. But it was the same configuration, and it was, in some ways, the same struggle. This time, the key to that struggle was the U.S. policy of containment, which sought to put a ring of U.S. allied nations around the entire communist bloc of China and Russia. And so there was NATO, there was CENTO, you know, there was Baghdad, and I mean, Iraq and Iran were part of that. And the new nation of Pakistan, you know, when it was born, it became a firm member of this treaty alliance. And then there was other favorable nations in Southeast Asia. So within all of that, Afghanistan was a non-aligned chink in the fence, you know. And it was through there that if it became part of, you know, if communists took that, then that would provide that same kind of access into the India and out of, you know, would be the break in the fence, and containment would be lost. So the U.S. was very interested in not allowing communism to take over Afghanistan. At the same time, the Soviet Union, you know, if the U.S. really took over Afghanistan and it became a firm U.S.-allied chip, then that would complete this containment fence, and it would really ring in, you know, fence in the Soviet Union. So they were also very interested in gaining control and gaining influence in Afghanistan. And the ruling family of that time looked, you know, at the two and said, my goodness, if we can just play one off against the other, we can create a little space here where we actually have a little bit of autonomy and sovereignty. And that's what they did, and they played that neutrality, that non-aligned game, just expertly for quite a few years. And by playing that game, they were able to extract development aid from one side and then development aid from the other side. And the one thing that proved problematic is that eventually they fell into having all of their military officers educated in the Soviet bloc, and they sent all their engineers and civil, you know, experts, they sent those students to the West to be educated. And so they ended up having, you know, a military that was permeated by leftist thought, and they had a civil bureaucracy that was oriented towards the West.
And then at what point did the Soviet Union go from having an interest in Afghanistan to actually moving into Afghanistan?
Well, it began with a coup d'etat by a group of, by an Afghan communist group, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan. And I'm not sure, and people have different opinions about that, whether or not the Soviet Union was actually involved in that coup. Most people think the Soviet Union had its eye on Afghanistan and eventually would have liked to have taken over, but they didn't intend to do a coup d'etat and take over just like that right at that moment. But it happened, and it happened because, you know, the king of the time, the prime minister, he called himself a president. Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah, anyway, he moved against the communists, and he was going to... So they struck back, and they took over. And then they couldn't control the country. And because they couldn't control it, now the Soviet Union was faced with a prospect of losing a country that had gone communist. And so they invaded to protect the revolution there.
And then what impact did ensuing violence have on the rise of what I guess ultimately would become terrorist organizations in the country in the decades that followed? I
mean, the first thing that happened is that the country was destroyed, and the Soviet Union, in coming into Afghanistan, devastated it far more than any previous incursion or invasion, maybe at least going back to the times of Genghis Khan. And it was a policy that sought to depopulate the countryside in order to ensure that guerrilla insurgents would not have any place to shelter or any bases to hide out in within the country. And that's, you know, what had made the insurgency so difficult for the Soviets. That deliberate policy ended up creating 6 million Afghan refugees outside the country and largely reduced the inside of the country to armed men organized into guerrilla bands roaming around and cut off from their families. So that really, you know, destroyed the social fabric of Afghanistan. And when the Cold War ended and the Soviets left and everybody else left, then this country, this territory, was just left in a state of chaos. And into that chaos moved first the Taliban, which was an organized group that had been formed by certain interests in Pakistan and was, staffed, so to speak, by Afghan boys who had grown up in the refugee camps. And they moved in and they established a kind of order in parts of Afghanistan. And there was a certain amount of relief amongst Afghans at the order that they did bring. And then once they had gained control of parts of Afghanistan, they opened the gates and let groups like Al-Qaeda come in and establish base camps and stuff. Because ideologically, they approved of the jihadists, and the jihadists approved of them. They washed each other's backs.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your questions and comments about Afghanistan for Tamim Ansari at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we'll go to Paul in Champaign County. Good morning, Paul.
Hi. I'm sorry I haven't been listening from the beginning. I missed, but... So I hope I'm not redundant in any way. But on the subject you're just talking about, there's the famous quote from Zbigniew Brzezinski about not worrying about a few stirred-up Muslims if it was worth engaging Russia and the Soviet Union then in the Great Game. And it seems to me that it's still controversial, but it's fairly to comment on that the U.S. was trying to draw Soviet Union into Afghanistan. I don't know if those are both controversial, but that's referring to what you were just speaking of. But I'm wondering whether you know about the book Crossing Zero, published by City Lights Books. I can't remember the author's name. It's a couple.
Don't know that one.
But the zero line is the Durand line, and I wanted you to comment on that because it's a colonial line, and. Tariq Ali, in his book The Duel about Pakistan, mentions that this Fatah region was under the same kind of 100-year rule that Hong Kong was, that it was seen as a colonial, you know, century-long line, and they did those things in those days, and that the Fatah should actually revert to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
If, There's a lot going on there, actually.
Yeah, you started with saying U.S. drew Soviets in, and I think probably what happened is neither side was really prepared for it, but there was a coup d'etat. And once it was, the coup d'etat happened, and then the Soviets invaded. Brzezinski was very happy about that because he saw Afghanistan as the quagmire that was going to tie up and bleed the Soviet Union the way Vietnam had done to the United States. That administration did not at all think in terms of the Afghans actually winning that war. They just thought if we supply a minimal amount of money and arms, they can just keep going for a long time and bleed the Soviet Union. And so it was like, yeah, well, there's a lot of Afghans. We can tie them down to the last Afghan. Things went south from there. The Durand Line, it's an interesting thing because, you know, I said earlier, that was the line that was established in order to demarcate the line of the zone of influence of the Afghans from that of the British. And I think that, you know, when you look at that Durand Line, it makes no sense on the map. Why is it there? And the answer of why is it there is because at the time it was drawn, the British calculated that that was as far forward as they could actually push and hold. And beyond that, the Afghans in their mountains and with their guerrilla armies and stuff would be too much trouble, you know, to fight. Which means that the Durand Line was established as a line of scrimmage, and it guaranteed that that's where skirmish and violence would occur, as it does on every line of scrimmage. Mm-hmm. Over the 100 years of the treaty that established it, that became the line that really marked off one nation state from another, and it functioned in that way, and it was probably doing a good job. But what's interesting to notice now is that it has kind of dissolved. You know, that's one of the things that's problematic over there, is that that line marking off one nation from another has actually become a belt of confusion and disorder where the people who live there don't really, you know, have allegiance or think of themselves as the citizens of either of these two states. They kind of think of themselves as being independent or part of some other thing.
John is in Champaign. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a question. In some of the things I've read, they indicate that the Soviet incursion into Afghanistan was in part motivated by Soviet fear of militant Islam spreading into the Union. Does that have any credibility?
No, I don't think at that time anybody gave any credence to the idea that militant Islam would be a power worth reckoning with. I think that later, you know, after the Soviets left, they did continue to fund one of the guerrillas who had been fighting them. Ahmad Shah Massoud was a top Afghan guerrilla leader, and he was you know, armed and supported by not so much by the Soviets. You know, that was gone by the Russians and other people in the north. And they were concerned about militant Islam coming across the border and spreading into the various stands and into Russia itself, which, in fact, has happened. So the fear was not misplaced.
We have just a couple of minutes left. What steps do you think are necessary to allow freedom, as we might define it in the West, to flourish in Afghanistan?
Well, I think, you know, what's required is that there be a period of violence-free negotiations among the factions and forces that are in Afghanistan. It won't be completely violence-free. That's just too much to ask for, but to try to create a circumstance in which the relevant foreign powers, which would be at this point the United States, Iran, China, India, Pakistan, Turkey, and to some extent Russia, those are the powers that are surrounding Afghanistan and pushing into it. If those people could come to some agreement to keep a neutral zone in Afghanistan, to jointly protect the neutrality of Afghanistan, then Afghans would begin to work out their own contradictions. They'd have a chance to address these questions we've been talking about. And they would come to something that we might not, particularly here in the West, say, oh, that's a good thing. They'll have their own solution to it. But I'd say that 40-year period when the ruling dynasty moved the country along in a progressive direction in that slow way demonstrates that Afghans themselves would be going in this direction if they didn't have to also be contending with, you know, a foreign invasion and these other chaotic circumstances.
Are you generally optimistic or pessimistic about Afghanistan's future?
You know, I'm both, but I think I am optimistic and pessimistic, but since everybody else seems to be only pessimistic, the fact that optimism is in there makes me say, I guess I'm sort of optimistic.
Okay. Tamima Ansari is a writer, lecturer, editor, and teacher. He directs the San Francisco Writers Workshop, teaches through the Osher Institute. He's written extensively about Afghanistan and the complicated relationship between Islam and the West. And his new book is Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Hey, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, Brian Johnson will join us to talk about cameras and photography. He is a professor of journalism at the University of Illinois, and he stops by from time to time to talk about the changing technology of picture taking. We can take questions on equipment and also on technique. Whether you're a pro or a serious hobbyist, you shoot film or digital, whatever the case may be, your call will be welcome. That's on tomorrow's program. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey, Kimberly Cronick, and Jim Meadows. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks so much for joining us.